When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Early Modern History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with A. Katie Harris, Associate Professor of History at University of California, Davis, to talk about her new book, The Stolen Bones of St. John of Matha, Forgery, Theft, and Sainthood in the 17th Century. It's out this year, that's 2023, with Penn State University Press. Hello, Katie, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. I'm so happy to be talking to you. How are you today? How's California?
The sun is coming through the fog. It's going to be a nice day.
Outstanding. Are you teaching this semester?
I am indeed. Yes. So you caught me right before classes are going to get going for the day.
Brilliant. Oh, I hope you're inspired. You'll go and smile on your face. All right. So then you're a busy, busy human being. Let's get into this story. So it starts here on March 18th, 1655, the eve of the Feast of St. Joseph at 11 o'clock at night. Two Spanish friars, lay brothers of the traditional Arcaced branch of the Order of the Most Holy Trinity of the Captives, left their Roman monastery and hurried out into the night. Outstanding opening to the book, and I love everything about it, including the fact that you know that it's 11 o'clock at night, exactly on this date, which is such a cool thing about these sources. But so that's how it starts. What happens next? Tell me the premise of this book.
Well, these two friars tiptoe across Rome. It is, of course, the middle of the night. There is a curfew. So they are breaking curfew and they traverse the city and basically engage in a little breaking and entering. They bust into a small church that lies in, at that time, what was a kind of quasi-abandoned part of the city. And they get into the church and do a few little perfunctory, a few little preface things. They say some prayers and get ready for what they're about to do. And then they pull out a pry bar and they break and open the tomb and proceed to steal the bones that are inside. And the bones that they are concerned with are the bones of St. John of Matha, or San Juan de Matha, who was the founder of their order. He died in 1213 and had been buried in this little tomb, in this little church in Rome. And they steal his bones and take them back to their monastery. For some reason, neglected to bring a bag with them. So one of the details that comes out of the records is that they made an improvised bag out of an undershirt, which really is not the way you're supposed to be treating the relics of saints. But, you know, here we are. So Then ensues the church is so nobody goes there. The church, nobody discovers it for quite a while. But then it's the theft is discovered, and there's a hue and a cry, and they are condemned. But in the meantime, they have left. They flee Rome, and together with their superior, their head of their monastery, and they tiptoe out of the city and head down to Naples, which is Spanish controlled. And in Naples, they, all three of them, the two thieves and their boss, essentially, get on a ship and sail back to Spain with their ill-gotten booty. It's quite a story. That's just a start.
That in itself is quite a story. Like the prayers and the theft going together, which makes perfect sense in this universe where you steal bones. It was great. Okay, but before we get to the kind of the rest of this case, how did you find out about it? Where did you stumble across this?
You know, this project has a long and winding course, as most projects do. I was originally going to try to write a completely different book, a totally different book. And I did a lot of research toward that book, and then I'm not going to write that book. So the original project was one in which I was interested in the Roman catacombs, which are, you know, the ancient cemeteries that lie underneath the city of Rome. And many of these are Christian, but they're also important Jewish cemeteries under Rome. You can also find pagan tombs. And I was particularly interested in the rediscovery of these tombs. They were never fully forgotten, but they were sort of came back to public attention in the latter decades of the 16th century. And then begins this enormous kind of process of removal, lots of bones being taken out of the cemeteries on the assumption that the bones there, the Christian bones, are of Christian martyrs who died at the hands of the Roman Empire. And they get shipped all around the Catholic world, right? So that was the original project. And that didn't work. There's almost too much material. Historians, we often have problems, like sometimes the problem is not enough material, and sometimes the problem is too much material. And there was too much material, and I was floundering, and I didn't know what to do. And I was exploring other avenues, and one of the ones that came forward to me was, I think an old friend mentioned that, you know, he was aware of this case. While I was trying to figure out how to rescue my book, I followed up on it and realized that one of the main centers, one of the main houses for this religious order, is located in Rome. And kind of went over there one day and talked to officials in charge of the church. And he said, oh, you should talk to Father so-and-so. And I ended up talking to Father so-and-so, who turned out to be a lovely person. While the Trinitarian Order is an international order, it is often kind of heavily Spanish, and historically has been so. And this particular official was, he's from southern Spain, so he speaks Andalus Spanish, which is actually something that I speak. And so we communicated very well. And the next thing I knew, he's like, yeah, sure, you can look at our documents. And there they were. So sometimes you have to kind of poke around and go in the wrong direction a bit before you find where you're going, and just play all the angles, and sometimes one will work out.
Wow, that's a great story. I mean, that's a lovely story. That's, you know, that's as good as it can be, I think, really. You've got this, you know, your documentary record that's pretty strong. Tell us about the sources.
Oh, the sources are wonderful. These are legal briefs for the most part, and documentation of all kinds, letters, legal briefs. Sometimes they're notes jotted on pieces of paper and have been shoved into this file. And they're all from the 17th century. So the paperwork goes from the 17th century. Some of it's 18th century. I didn't really look at the 19th century stuff because that was beyond what I wanted. And every once in a while, I'd find something 20th century, which would be interesting too. You'd find a 20th century document put in there with the 17th century ones. There was a logic to it. And they're lovely. Some of them are a little hard to read, especially when somebody's writing quickly. They're mostly in Latin or Spanish, sometimes in Italian. So sometimes any given document will occasionally change languages on you. So you have to be a little bit on your toes in terms of what language you're working in. But and they're voluminous. They're often no page numbers. There's no index. There's no page numbers. So the first thing you have to do is figure out what it is you have in front of you and where does it fit, if it fits into what you're trying to do.
Where is the stack? With the understanding that if you're not the first person to look at it, and you're not, who knows what kind of order it was in or is now?
Precisely. Yeah. So you have to respect whatever order it's in. You mustn't reorder the paper, the pages. Absolutely not. That's really wrong, and it's just not done. But the logic of the arrangement of the materials is not always evident. So a lot of the work that happens on the back end is figuring out what you have in front of you, what its kind of dimensions are. Is it 500 pages or is it 5 pages? And almost creating your own index. There's a lot of the historian's work is this grunt work that nobody sees, that is creating your own finding tools, creating your own methods for trying to organize the material. The rector of the house, the kind man who allowed me to use the materials, allowed me to take photographs, which was a godsend. And not everybody will let you do that. I've worked in many, many archives where they're like, what? No, absolutely not. You can't take photos. Okay. I guess I'm just going to do this by hand. But he was kind enough to let me take photos. But then of course I have literally hundreds of photos that need to be organized. So there's a kind of dual process of organizing there too. And all of that comes before the actual analysis.
Sure. Right. Sometimes before you even get to really read the document, much less think about what it might mean.
Right.
And taking photos is great. You have it and you can come back to these points. But at the same time, I used to leave the archive knowing what I had. And now.
Right. Exactly. On the other hand, during the pandemic, the photos were an absolute godsend because, you know, of course, we were like everybody else on the planet. I couldn't go anywhere. There was no going anywhere. There was no doing anything. So a lot of the pandemic was spent me kind of combing through the photos, putting them in order, figuring out what they were and doing that kind of work. There's a lot of deciphering on the back end that has to be done.
Yeah, all right. So there are a couple axes here upon which the story really turns, and one of them are relics, right? Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners what these are.
Oh, relics are so interesting. So the thing one has to understand is that when we talk about relics of saints, we're talking about the most common understanding is they are the physical remains of a person considered to be holy, or especially especially holy. There's more to it than that. We could sometimes I like to define saints as God's friends, right? That and so they're, you know, they're especially close to God in that, in a kind of friendly way, in a relationship way. And the physical remains can be anything from, you know, bones or hair in some cases, or if we're talking about relics of, say, the Virgin Mary or of Christ, right? That those two figures in Christian tradition didn't leave a body behind, right? Christ ascended to heaven, Mary was brought up into heaven, and so it might, it's not going to be, you're never going to see, as if anybody shows you a relic of Christ that's Christ's like leg bone, don't take that one very seriously. That doesn't fit with the larger story. But you do find things like, you know, hairs of the Virgin Mary or breast milk, things like that. So physical remains, but it can also, those are what we call primary relics. So sort of first instance relics, but there can also be secondary relics or tertiary relics. And these are objects that might have been used by that person, that special person, like a hairbrush or a pen or a particularly important, you know, devotional book that the saint carried around with her. Or in third instance, it could be something that has been touched too, either a secondary or a primary relic. And there's a kind of idea of the charge of the sacred charge being transferred in a sense into the remains, into the object. And that a person, a devotee, somebody who is, who to whom that saint is important, can in a way access the saint, access that power, access the connection that the saint has to God by through the relic, right? And there are more or less orthodox uses and approaches to relics. And one of the things, and so I, of course, work on the 16th and 17th centuries, and this is a period in which the church is working hard to both promote the veneration of relics, which is rejected soundly by Protestants, right? Luther has, and Calvin in particular, Calvin has a lot to say on the subject of relics. But so the work is, the church is working hard to promote the veneration of relics, but also to kind of turn back or pull back tendencies amongst the laity, amongst the public, to use them or to venerate them in ways that might be a little overboard, maybe a little unorthodox. So there's an interesting kind of push and pull at this moment in which relics are both being promoted, but also you have church officials going, wait, no, don't do that. Do it this way, right? To try to... I like to think of it as kind of like making canals. So if you have a river, right, rivers rush forward. So when making a canal allows the river to run, but it puts it into appropriate channels, right?
Oh, that's great. That's a great kind of visual for this. Because they're little supernatural bits, right? They're very powerful.
Yeah, they are understood to be very powerful and to have a relic. I mean, there are rules on the books about who is allowed to have them and who is not. That doesn't, just because a rule exists doesn't mean that people observe them, obviously. You know, that they are sites of power in a sense. And this, no surprise, this is why we see both in the late, well, actually medieval period. I was going to say late medieval, but it actually spans a larger time, not just the late medieval. And the early modern, we see important relic collections being put together, often by powerful people. The one that first comes to mind for me is, of course, enormous relic collection of Philip II, King of Spain, who has, if you go to the Escorial, the palace in Spain, it's a fantastic palace. It's really interesting. But one for me, the big draw is the relic collection, which is immense. That's just one example. I mean, lots of, it's kind of like a kind of fashionable amongst the nobility of the, you know, the second half of the 16th century and in maybe the first half or more of the 17th century to be collecting relics. So powerful people collecting powerful objects, if you want.
So fashionable for very powerful secular leaders, but just fashionable maybe, but essential for lay leaders, for religious leaders, right?
For religious leaders, of course. I mean, so they too are collecting them. And any church, well, all churches are supposed to have relics, right? In order to consecrate a relic, an altar, excuse me, you need to have a relic. It's also that relics, especially ones that acquire a reputation for being particularly powerful, are important draws for a church, right? So you want to attract people, you want to attract attention to your particular church or your monastery or your pilgrimage site. Relics are important for that. That because they will bring people. People will want to come and visit them, come and see them, come and ask to have them applied to their wounds or their infirm leg or whatever, seeking a miracle, that kind of thing. So they're important, really important for this period.
They're really important. It brings people to see you. It's a revenue increaser.
Can be.
It also adds legitimacy. Yeah.
It can. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they're kind of fascinatingly multi-purpose objects. But the thing I also like to think about relics is that we talk about them as objects, but they have to also be understood that the relic is a person, especially if we're talking about a primary relic, right? The bone of a saint, in that they operate. There's a kind of that the part is equivalent to the whole. So wherever a fragment is, that the saint is understood to be present, wholly present there, right? So, you might seek out you're particularly devoted to a specific saint. You want to ask a favor, want to help. Where that relic is, a small fragment, you know, the tiniest bone fragment, the saint is fully present there. And there's that's a real attractor, that as a kind of a sight.
My next question may seem really idiotic, but there's a point I want to make with it. So go with me on this. But are they real?
I don't think that's a useful question, to tell you the truth. And that's a question I get a lot. And I mean, what does real mean? I'll just turn it back, right? What does real mean? If you're saying, are all relics truly what people say they are or what people claim they are? Obviously not. But that's never the point, is it? Now, if we're talking, if we're talking about, a relic of a fairly recent saint, that's highly likely to be, because the recentness, the further back in time a thing comes out of, right, the more likely there is to be a certain kind of slippage. But again, it's not really the point. The point is not, is the thing real, whatever that means. It's more, what is it that people say about it? What is it that people say about that object? Why do they say that? How do they say that? What are the stories they tell? That, I think, is a more interesting question. There's a kind of, I get this question a lot, and I always find it sort of like, well, what do you mean by that? Why are you asking that? It's more interesting to ask the question of, well, what is it that people are saying, than it is to ask about, is it truly, in many cases, like, how can we possibly know? What are we going to do? Run carbon 14 dating on these things? No.
DNA to find whether that voice box is really San Antonio. But if it's been, it's in the church. They say it's the piece of the saint. People have been coming to see it for hundreds of years. Of course it's real.
Right. It's real in that sense. Whatever and whatever, whatever they people say at a certain point, whatever, what is said is true at a certain level, right? It's more important in that way.
But at the same time, there is concern about making sure these are verifiable. There is Absolutely. A fake relic trade that's very powerful. Sure. Right.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that my work gets into is that while yes, it's in a certain sense, there's not a lot, like it is what people say it is, that there is of course that a process, there are methods for evaluating, right? And this is particularly important for the church in this period, right? That there's a concern with evaluating and call it, there's, you know, what kind of evidence is there that this object is what people say it is. And so looking at the ways in which arguments are made about these things and the evidence that is brought forward and the nature of evidence changes in this period, right? If we look at older cases, sort of early medieval or sort of central Middle Ages period, there's forms of evidence like trial by fire, like say, can you test a relic and put it in a fire and will it come out of that fire unscathed is a viable method, right? And we have interesting records about that. By the time we get to the period that I'm looking at, nobody's doing that. It's all been put aside. There are interesting discussions by scholars about how they used to do that, but now they don't. But instead, there's a lot of really interesting discussion about, well, what can we look for? How can we evaluate these things and put forward to the laity objects that we feel have as authentic as we can evaluate, right? And evidence is always going to be flawed because it's humans that are making that. And anything humans do, the narratives we create, the stories we tell, the things we can know is inevitably going to be incomplete. And so working with that necessary incompleteness, you know, how can we investigate these things? So one of the things that my research works on or has looked at is the methods whereby these things are investigated and evaluated, and what we see the investigators, and they're usually members of the clergy, but not exclusively, examining all of the historical documentation and examining the kinds of records that are associated with these objects, looking at their physical characteristics really carefully. In the case of the bones, the stolen bones of St. John of Matha, one of the things that's put forward is that the bones are very carefully examined and they're very white colored, right? And that's important. The size of them, the color of them, often relics are supposedly have a special smell, right? It's called the odor of sanctity. And somebody, you can have a metaphoric odor of sanctity, but you can also have a kind of a literal odor of sanctity. In the case of the bones of St. John of Matha, I didn't find anybody referring to the way they smell. But in other work that I've done, other research, I've lots of discussions about, oh, and by the way, did you notice the smell? The smell, I can't define it. What is it? Is it flowers? No, it's not flowers. What if this kind of the smell of holiness itself? All of the human senses, if you want.
And there's an historical record around these as well, right? So we have historians writing the history of bones.
Absolutely. There's a historical record, and often the bones themselves, any given relic will have, they're fascinating, these little tags, right? A tag or a label attached to it. And we can learn a lot from the tags and labels. They are the tags and labels, they're called authentica, right? So they authenticate the thing. And we can learn a lot from the tags and labels, just even by looking at the handwriting on them. You could find a lot about the history of the thing just by looking at it. But of course, there's provenance records, and there might be documentation saying, oh, this bone was given by so-and-so to so-and-so. Here's the documentation attached to it. Here is the witness testimony attached to it. So we can look at things like that as well. All kinds of different possibilities for how to examine the authenticity of these objects.
Mm-hmm. And the authenticity of people. I mean, there are fake saints. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that we see a lot in this period is the church being quite concerned about living people at the time who are being put forward either by their followers or sometimes even by themselves as saints, right? And to be a vetted, approved saint is not something that anybody is supposed to be doing for themselves, right? No self-respecting saint would ever call themselves a saint, right? That's something saints are, other people make saints. Saints don't make themselves, right? That has everything to do with the stories that grow up around people after they're gone. But also we have lots of really interesting cases of people or religious orders or towns or other institutions kind of putting forward figures from the past as saints that may or may not have ever existed. So the whole subject becomes a really fascinating playground for the historian because there's so many things that we have to sort out. We have to work really hard to try to figure out what's going on, who's saying what, why are they saying these things? And, you know, reading texts with one eye towards who's benefiting and how can I tell, how literally can I take this? Probably not much. Versus, you know, taking the story at face value and running with it. We have to do all these things at the same time.
And as you discussed, I mean, the church is doing this too. The contemporary reforming early modern church is also trying really hard to figure, because saints are great, but fake saints are bad. And the Protestants have a lot to say about that.
Absolutely. Exactly. And this is precisely this moment when the church is putting in place procedures, putting in place and has been, I mean, it's not brand new in this period. This is something that's been developing over the course of centuries, but putting in place procedures and methods and institutional apparatus for evaluating all of these things. So there's been some really interesting work done, for example, on the ways in which investigation of recently dead people who have a reputation for holiness, the way in which physical inspection of their bodies and autopsy is used as a way of investigating holiness and verifying the kind of status of a person. So the methods are different depending upon if somebody's recently dead or if you have late antique martyr, you know, it's different depending on how long dead somebody is. It kind of, your methods will vary.
Sure. Uncorrupted corpses mean different things based on time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's get back to your guy. Who's St. John of Matha?
Well, you look at the original, like sort of the earliest sources, we don't actually know that much about him. We have to make a distinction between what we know from the earliest sources versus the stories that grow up over the course of the centuries. But he appears to have been originally from Provence in southern France, appears to have been a professor in Paris who, according to the way his legend goes, that he had a mystical experience while officiating at Mass. And in this experience, he saw the figure of Christ and two captives. And one of the captives is a white person, and the other person captive is a black person. And that this experience of seeing this mystical vision led him to found a religious order, the Order of the Most Holy Trinity and of the Captives. And this religious order, which is founded in 1198 and still exists, of course, had as its main mission the rescue and redemption from slavery of Christian captives who wind up in the hands of non-Christian captors. So usually that means, for the period we're talking about, usually it means Muslims. So it could be in whatever part of the Islamic world we might find this happening. It's usually especially rescuing Christian captives from Islamic territories in North Africa, or it might be in parts of Spain that are under Muslim control. It, of course, changes over time. So that's the main kind of mission of this religious order. And that's, I mean, there are other stories that develop about him as in miracle stories and all this stuff, but that's the core of it right there.
Well, and explains how the order gets its mission as well.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Great founding story. So, and so I get, all right, that's saint worthy, but why do these guys who are Gonzalo and Jose, why do they want to steal his bones?
That's a great question. I mean, why you don't usually bust into the tomb of the founder of your religious order. It's, that's just not really done. I just like to say, like, make it clear that people don't usually do this. The issue is this, is that for all of St. John of Matha's importance to the Trinitarian order, the order never got around to having him canonized. That is, he was a saint in their eyes, but not a canonized saint. And for many hundreds of years, that didn't matter because canonization was often a fairly informal matter. But over the course of the late medieval period, and as we move into the early modern period, formal canonization becomes more and more important. And that's a papal-controlled process. And in the beginning of, by the time we get to the late 16th century, it's getting a little embarrassing, frankly, that their founder isn't canonized. And some of their rivals, other orders, have been dealing with this, right? And so, especially in the first few decades of the 17th century, in the early 1600s, their key rival order is the Mercedarians, the Blessed Virgin of Mercy. And they're rivals to the Trinitarians. So it's Mercedarians versus Trinitarians. And they're rivals because the Mercedarians have the same mission, right? They're also engaged in rescuing Christian captives from Islamic territories. So the two orders are constantly struggling with each other for over centuries. They're suing each other all the time. They're forever. I mean, it's just endless. And because they're fighting for the same donor base, essentially, right? There's only so many donations to go around, and both groups want the same amount of money. The Mercedarians, however, have gotten around. They get their founder canonized. Now the Trinitarians have a problem. Their founder is not formally canonized. It's a real issue. And now, you wouldn't normally steal the bones of somebody you're trying to get canonized, but there's a real issue. The problem is that the little church that the bones of St. John of Matha were in wasn't actually under the control of the Trinitarians. for reasons that are too boring and lengthy to go into, it was under the control of the Vatican itself. So the Trinitarians don't control the church. They don't have ready access to the tomb of their founder. And that means that there's nothing in the church that demonstrates any devotion to that saint. They call him a saint, but the Vatican's like, I don't know. Like, nobody seems to care about him. Nobody's visiting the tomb. I don't see any candles here. I don't see any evidence of any kind of devotion to the saint. And so stealing the bones is it's a kind of extreme thing to do, but it's a way of short-circuiting that problem as the order is working towards the canonization of their founder. I don't think it's an entirely successful kind of approach, in that they have this whole new problem of the fact that now the bones have been stolen. They were taken to Rome and they were taken to Spain from Rome, totally illegally. There's no record of the extraction, right? So there's none of the documentary apparatus that would be expected. And Rome is going to say, okay, so you say those are the bones of your founder. Now you have to prove it, right? Where before that wasn't an issue, now it's an issue. So by trying to solve one problem, a new problem was created, essentially. And it takes, you know, decades and decades to resolve.
Sure. In the end, is he a saint?
Yes. They get the canonization goes through, and he's canonized in 1666. The order there's a kind of mental space. Okay, we got him canonized. Now we could turn around and deal with this problem that we created when we stole the bones, and begin the process of applying to prove basically a different court case that these are the relics of St. John of Matha. It's messy. It's not a tidy story, unfortunately.
It's not a tidy story, which is part of what makes it such a fun thing to think about, and a really good book. There's more to this story that I'm not going to go into. We're not going to talk about today, but you listeners, really, you should read this book. It is a nice, quick, enjoyable read. Like, this is a book that a beach read might be a stretch, but I would. It's definitely the kind of book that I give to people who are like, what's a good history book I can read? You know, who may or may not be historians as well as historians. So, well done.
Awesome. I love the idea of somebody sitting on a beach reading about St. John of Matha. That tickles me.
Yeah. Isn't it? Maybe. I don't know. All right. So thanks for taking so much time with me. I have just one more question, which is, we talked about it a little before we started recording. You're working on a conference paper. So what's next? What's the new research?
Cleaning up a few odds and ends from the St. John of Matha work, but trying to take my work in a totally different connect direction. I have worked on relics for like 25 years total, and it's time to move into I'm done with dead bodies, and I want to work on live bodies now. And so I am in the beginning process of trying to figure out how to do this, but I'm interested in priestly bodies, right? And the physical body of a priest, and especially the masculine body of the priest, right? That priests in the Catholic Church must be male. So the priestly body is by necessity a male body. And I'm curious, I'm interested in what is priestly masculinity? What does it mean to be a man and to be a priest, especially in this period? So I'm in the very beginning stages of this. I did a little research trip earlier this year to go
poke around some Episcopal archives that in Toledo and in Burgos, looking at records there, especially of priests gone wrong, essentially. So priests who wind up in being investigated by their bishops for things like, being, first of all, physical disability is part of it, right? So priests who are getting old and maybe are not able to do the kinds of duties that they need to do, but also priests who wind up in trouble. There's one fantastic case that I don't know what to do with yet, but of a priest who's in really bad terms with his neighbors. This is the late 17th century in Toledo, and winds up, he's pulling guns on them and ambushing them as they're trying to go out of town to go tell the bishop what he's doing. It's great. So I don't know how to deal with it yet, but that's the plan.
I'm fascinated. I want to know all of that. Yeah, priest masculinity should be very cool to think about, because there's this pastoral paternalistic kind of business, but from a celibate, that'll be cool.
Exactly. So I'm not sure where it's going, but it's at least everybody's alive, not dead now.
Well, that's exciting. And a new project is so exciting. It's nothing but promise. There's
absolutely
so many places it could go, and haven't had to write it down yet, which is actually
not yet. Got nothing to write yet.
That's wonderful. All right. Listeners, this was The Stolen Bones of St. John of Matha. You can find a link to it on our website. And Katie, thanks so much again for taking time to talk to me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.